Villa di Quarto, January 1904. This villa is situated 3 or 4 miles from Florence and has several names. Some call it the Villa Reale di Quarto, some call it the Villa Principessa, some call it the Villa Granduchessa. This multiplicity of names was an inconvenience to me for the first 2 or 3 weeks. For as I had heard the place called by only one name, when letters came for the servants directed to the care of one or the other of the other names, I supposed a mistake had been made and remailed them. It has been explained to me that there is a reason for these several names. Its name Quarto it gets from the district which it is in, it being in the 4 mile radius from the center of Florence. It is called Reale because the King of Württemberg occupied it at one time. Principessa and Granduchessa, because a Russian daughter of the imperial house occupied it at another. There is a history of the house somewhere, and some time or other I shall get it and see if there are any details in it which could be of use in this chapter. I should like to see that book, for as an evolutionist I should like to know the beginning of this dwelling and the several stages of its evolution. Baedeker says it was built by Cosimo I, by blank, architect. I have learned this within the past 3 minutes, and it wrecks my development scheme. I was surmising that the house began in a small and humble way, and was the production of a poor farmer whose idea of home and comfort it was, that following him a generation or two later came a successor of better rank and larger means who built an addition, that successor after successor added more bricks and more bulk as time dragged on, each in his turn leaving a detail behind him of paint or wallpaper to distinguish his reign from the others, that finally in the last century came the three that precede me, and added their specialties. The King of Württemberg broke out room enough in the center of the building, about 100 feet from each end of it, to put in the great staircase, a cheap and showy affair, almost the only wooden thing in the whole edifice, and as comfortable and sane and satisfactory as it is out of character with the rest of the asylum. The Russian princess, who came with native superstitions about cold weather, added the hot air furnaces in the cellar and the vast green majolica stove in the great hall where the king's staircase is, a stove which I thought might possibly be a church, a nursery church for children, so imposing is it for size and so richly adorned with basso-relievos of an ultra-pious sort. It is loaded and fired from a secret place behind the partition against which it is backed. Last of all came Satan also, the Countess Massilia, present owner of the house, an American product, and male in everything but sex. She added a cheap and stingy arrangement of electric bells, inadequate acetylene gas plant, obsolete water closets, perhaps a dozen pieces of machine-made boarding-house furniture, and some fire auction carpets which blaspheme the standards of color and art all day long, and never quiet down until the darkness comes and pacifies them. However, if the house was built for Cosimo 400 years ago and with an architect on deck, I suppose I must dismiss those notions about the gradual growth of the house in bulk. Cosimo would want a large house, he would want to build it himself so that he could have it just the way he wanted it. I think he had his will. In the architecture of this barrack there has been no development. There was no architecture in the first place, and none has been added except the king's meretricious staircase, the princess's ecclesiastical stove, and the countess's obsolete water closets. I am speaking of art architecture. There is none. There is no more architecture of that breed discoverable in this long stretch of ugly and ornamentless three-storied house front than there is about a rope walk or a bowling alley. The shape and proportions of the house suggest those things, it being 200 feet long by 60 wide. There is no art architecture inside the house. There is none outside. We arrive now at practical architecture, the useful, the indispensable, which plans the inside of a house and by wisely placing and distributing the rooms, or by stupidly and ineffectually distributing them, makes the house a convenient and comfortable and satisfactory abiding place, or the reverse. The inside of the house is evidence that Cosimo's architect was not in his right mind. And it seems to me that it is not fair and not kind in Baedeker to keep on exposing his name and his crime down to this late date. I am nobler than Baedeker and more humane, and I suppress it. I don't remember what it was, anyway. I shall go into the details of this house, not because I imagine it differs much from any other old-time palace or new-time palace on the continent of Europe, but because every one of its crazy details interests me, and therefore may be expected to interest others of the human race, particularly women. When they read novels, they usually skip the weather, but I have noticed that they read with avidity all that a writer says about the furnishings, decorations, conveniences, and general style of a home. The interior of this barrack is so chopped up and systemless that one cannot deal in exact numbers when trying to put its choppings up into statistics. In the basement or cellar, there are as follows. Stalls and boxes for many horses, right under the principal bedchamber. The horses noisily dance to the solicitations of the multitudinous flies all night. Feed stores, carriage house, acetylene gas plant, a vast kitchen put out of use years ago, another kitchen, coal rooms, coke rooms, peat rooms, wood rooms, three furnaces, wine rooms, various storerooms for all sorts of domestic supplies, lot of vacant and unclassified rooms, labyrinth of corridors and passages affording the stranger an absolute certainty of getting lost. A vast cesspool. It is cleaned out every 30 years. Couple of dark stairways leading up to the ground floor. About 20 divisions, as I count them. This cellar seems to be the full dimension of the house's foundations, say 200 feet by 60. The ground floor, where I am dictating, is cut up into 23 rooms, halls, corridors, and so forth. The next floor above contains 18 divisions of the like sort, one of which is the billiard room and another the great drawing room. The top story consists of 20 bedrooms and a furnace. Large rooms they necessarily are, for they are arranged 10 on a side, and they occupy that whole space of 200 feet long by 60 wide, except that there is a liberal passage or hallway between them. There are good fireplaces up there, and they would make charming bedchambers if handsomely and comfortably furnished and decorated. But there would need to be a lift. Not a European lift with its mere stand-up space and its imperceptible movement, but a roomy and swift American one. These rooms are reached now by the same process by which they were reached in Cosimo's time, by leg power. Their brick floors are bare and unpainted, their walls are bare, and painted the favorite European color, which is now and always has been an odious, stomach-turning yellow. It is said that these rooms were intended for servants only, and that they were meant to accommodate 2 or 3 servants apiece. It seems certain that they have not been occupied by any but servants in the last 50 or 100 years, otherwise they would exhibit some remains of decoration. If, then, they have always been for the use of servants only, where did Cosimo and his family sleep? Where did the King of Württemberg bestow his dear ones? For below that floor there are not any more than 3 good bedchambers and 5 devilish ones. With 80 cut-ups in the house and with but 4 persons in my family, this large fact is provable, that we can't invite a friend to come and stay a few days with us, because there is not a bedroom unoccupied by ourselves that we could offer him without apologies. In fact, we have no friend whom we love so little and respect so moderately as to be willing to stuff him into one of those vacant cells. Yes, where did the vanished aristocracy sleep? I mean the real aristocracy, not the American countess, for she required no room to speak of. When we arrived, her husband was far away in the Orient, serving his country in a diplomatic capacity. The countess's mother had gone home to America, and the countess was keeping solitary and unvisited state in this big mansion with her head servant, the steward of the estate, as society and protector. To go on with my details, this little room where I am dictating these informations on this 8th day of January, 1904, is on the east side of the house. It is level with the ground, and one may step from its 9 or 10 foot high vast door into the terrace garden, which is a great square level space, surrounded by an ornamental iron railing with vases of flowers distributed here and there along its top. It is a pretty terrace with abundant green grass, with handsome trees, with a great fountain in the middle, and with roses of various tints nodding in the balmy air and flashing back the rays of the January sun. Beyond the railing to the eastward stretches the private park, and through its trees curves the road to the far-off iron gate on the public road. where there is neither porter nor porter's lodge nor any way to communicate with the mansion. Yet from time immemorial, the Italian villa has been a fortress hermetically sealed up in high walls of masonry and with entrance guarded by locked iron gates. The gates of Italy have always been locked at nightfall and kept locked the night through. No Italian trusted his contadini neighbors in the old times, and his successor does not trust them now. There are bells and porters for the convenience of outsiders desiring to get in at other villas, but it is not the case with this one, and apparently never has been. Surely it must have happened now and then that these kings and nobilities got caught out after the gates were locked. Then how did they get in? We shall never know. The question cannot be answered. It must take its place with the other unsolved mystery of where the aristocracy slept during those centuries when they occupied this fortress. To return to that glass door, outside it are exceedingly heavy and coarse Venetian shutters, a fairly good defense against a catapult. These, like the leaves of the glass door, swing open in the French fashion, and I will remark in passing that, to my mind, the French window is as rational and convenient as the English-American window is the reverse of this. Inside the glass door, 3 or 4 inches inside of it, are solid doors made of boards, good and strong and ugly. The shutters, the glass door, and these wooden door defenses against intrusion of light and thieves are all armed with strong and heavy bolts which are shot up and down by the turning of a handle. The house walls being very thick, these doors and shutters and things do not crowd each other. There is plenty of space between them, and there is room for more in case we should get the feeling afraid. This shuttered glass door, this convenient exit to the terrace and garden, is not the only one on this side of the house from which one can as handily step upon the terrace. There is a procession of them stretching along, door after door, along the east or rear front of the house, from its southern end to its northern end, 11 in the procession. Beginning at the south end, they afford exit from a parlor, a large bedroom, mine, this little 12x20 reception room where I am now at work, and a 10x12 ditto, which is in effect the beginning of a corridor 40 feet long by 12 wide with 3 sets of triple glass doors for exit to the terrace. The corridor empties into a dining room, and the dining room into 2 large rooms beyond, all with glass door exits to the terrace. When the doors which connect these 7 rooms and the corridor are thrown open, the 200-foot stretch of variegated carpeting with its warring and shouting and blaspheming tumult of color makes a fine and almost contented receding and diminishing perspective, and one realizes that if some sane person could have the privilege and the opportunity of burning the existing carpets and instituting harmonies of color in their place, the reformed perspective would be very beautiful. Above each of the 11 glass doors is a duplicate on the next floor, 10 feet by 6 of glass, and above each of these on the topmost floor is a smaller window, 33 good openings for light on this eastern front, the same on the western front, and 9 of ampler size on each end of the house. 56 of these 84 windows contain double enough glass to equip the average window of an American dwelling, yet the house is by no means correspondingly light. I do not know why. Perhaps it is because of the dismal upholstering of the walls. Villa di Quarto is a palace. Cosimo built it for that. His architect intended it for that. It has always been regarded as a palace, and an old resident of Florence told me the other day that it was a good average sample of the Italian palace of the great nobility, and that its grotesqueness and barbarities, incongruities and destitution of conveniences are to be found in the rest. I am able to believe this because I have seen some of the others. I think there is not a room in this huge confusion of rooms and halls and corridors and cells and waste spaces which does not contain some memento of each of its illustrious occupants, or at least 2 or 3 of them. We will examine the parlor at the head of that long perspective which I have been describing. The arched ceiling is beautiful both in shape and decoration. It is finely and elaborately frescoed. The ceiling is a memento of Cosimo. The doors are draped with heavy pale blue silk, faintly figured. That is the King of Württemberg's relic. The gleaming white brass-banded porcelain pagoda which contains an open fireplace for wood is a relic of the Russian princess and a remembrancer of her native experiences of cold weather. The light gray wallpaper figured with gold flowers is anybody's. We care not to guess its pedigree. The rest of the room is manifestly a result of the Countess Massilia's occupation. its shouting in harmonies and disorders, manifestly had their origin in her chaotic mind. The floor is covered with a felt-like filling of strenuous red. One can almost see Pharaoh's host floundering in it. There are four rugs scattered about like islands, violent rugs whose colors swear at each other and at the Red Sea. There is a sofa upholstered in a coarse material, a frenzy of green and blue and blood, a cheap and undeceptive imitation of Florentine embroidery. There is a sofa and two chairs upholstered in pale green silk, figured. The wood is of three different breeds of American walnut, flimsy, cheap, machine-made. There is a French walnut sofa upholstered in figured silk of a fiendish, crushed strawberry tint of a faded aspect, and there is an armchair which is a mate to it. There is a plain and naked black walnut table without a cover to modify its nudity. Under it is a large, round ottoman covered with the palest of pale green silk, a sort of glorified mushroom which curses with all its might at the Red Sea and the furious rugs and the crushed strawberry relics. Against the wall stands a tall, glass-fronted bookcase, machine-made. The material, American butternut. It stands near enough to the King of Württemberg's heavy silken door drapery to powerfully accent its cheapness and ugliness by contrast. Upon the walls hang three good watercolors, six or eight very bad ones, a pious-looking portrait of the Countess in bridal veil and low neck, and a number of photographs of members of her tribe. One of them is a picture of the Count, who has a manly and intelligent face and looks like a gentleman. What possessed him to become proprietor of the Countess, he probably could not explain at this late day himself. The whole literature of this vast house is contained in that fire-auction American bookcase. There are four shelves. The top one is made up of indiscriminate literature of good quality. The next shelf is made up of cloth-covered books devoted to Christian Science and spiritualism. 40 thin books. The two remaining shelves contain 54 bound volumes of Blackwood, in date running backward from about 1870. This bookcase and its contents were probably imported from America by the Countess's mother, who tore herself away some months ago and returned to Philadelphia. One cannot attribute the Blackwoods to the Countess. They contain nothing that could interest her. It is most unlikely that the religious shelf could enlist her sympathies, her moral constitution being made up of envy, hate, malice, and treachery. She is easily the most fiendish character I have ever encountered in any walk of life. The room just described must be dignified with that imposing title, library, on account of the presence in it of that butternut bookcase and its indigent contents. It does duty now as a private parlor for Mrs. Clemens during those brief and widely separated occasions when she is permitted to leave for an hour the bed to which she has been so long condemned. We are in the extreme south end of the house, if there is any such thing as a south end to a house, where orientation cannot be determined by me, because I am incompetent in all cases where an object does not point directly north or south. This one slants across between and is therefore a confusion to me. This little private parlor is in one of the two corners of what I call the south end of the house. The sun rises in such a way that all the morning it is pouring its light in through the 33 glass doors or windows which pierce the side of the house which looks upon the terrace and garden, as already described. The rest of the day the light floods this south end of the house, as I call it. At noon, the sun is directly above Florence, yonder in the distance in the plain, directly above those architectural features which have been so familiar to the world in pictures for some centuries, the Duomo, the Campanile, the Tomb of the Medici, and the beautiful tower of the Palazzo Vecchio. Above Florence, but not very high above it, for it never climbs quite halfway to the zenith in these winter days, in this position it begins to reveal the secrets of the delicious blue mountains that circle around into the west, for its light discovers, uncovers, and exposes a white snowstorm of villas and cities that you cannot train yourself to have confidence in. They appear and disappear so mysteriously, and so as if they might be not villas and cities at all, but the ghosts of perished ones of the remote and dim Etruscan times. And late in the afternoon the sun sinks down behind those mountains, somewhere, at no particular time and at no particular place, so far as I can see. This library, or boudoir, or private parlor, opens into Mrs. Clemens's bedroom, and it and the bedroom together stretch all the way across the south end of the house. The bedroom gets the sun before noon and is prodigally drenched and deluged with it the rest of the day. One of its windows is particularly well calculated to let in a liberal supply of sunshine, for it contains 12 great panes, each of them more than 2 feet square. The bedroom is 31 feet long by 24 wide, and there has been a time when it and the library had no partition between, but occupied the whole breadth of the south end of the house in an unbroken stretch. It must have been a ballroom or banqueting room at that time. I suggest this merely because perhaps not even Cosimo would need so much bedroom, whereas it would do very well indeed as a banqueting room because of its proximity to the cooking arrangements, which were not more than 200 or 300 yards away, down cellar, a very eligible condition of things indeed in the old times. Monarchs cannot have the conveniences which we plebeians are privileged to luxuriate in. They can't even today. If I were invited to spend a week in Windsor Castle, it would gladden me and make me feel proud. But if there was any hint about regular boarders, I should let on that I didn't hear. As a palace, Windsor Castle is great, great for show, spaciousness, display, grandeur, and all that. But the bedrooms are small, uninviting, and inconvenient, and the arrangements for delivering food from the kitchen to the table are so clumsy and waste so much time that a meal there probably suggests recent cold storage. This is only conjecture. I did not eat there. In Windsor Castle, the courses are brought up by dumbwaiter from the profound depth where the vast kitchen is. They are then transferred by rail on a narrow little tramway to the territory where the dinner is to have place. This trolley was still being worked by hand when I was there 4 years ago. Still, it was without doubt a great advance upon Windsor Castle transportation of any age before Queen Victoria's. It is startling to reflect that what we call conveniences in a dwelling house, and which we regard as necessities, were born so recently that hardly one of them existed in the world when Queen Victoria was born. The valuable part, to my thinking the valuable part, of what we call civilization, had no existence when she emerged upon the planet. She sat in her chair in that venerable fortress and saw it grow from its mustard seed to the stupendous tree which it had become before she died. She saw the whole of the new creation, she saw everything that was made, and without her witness was not anything made that was made. A very creditable creation indeed, taking all things into account, since man, quite unassisted, did it all out of his own head. I jumped to this conclusion because I think that if Providence had been minded to help him, it would have occurred to Providence to do this some 100,000 centuries earlier. We are accustomed to seeing the hand of Providence in everything. Accustomed because if we missed it, or thought we missed it, we had discretion enough not to let on. We are a tactful race. We have been prompt to give Providence the credit of this fine and showy new civilization, and we have been quite intemperate in our praises of this great benefaction. We have not been able to keep still over this splendid 5-minute attention. We can only keep still about the ages of neglect which preceded it and which it makes so conspicuous. When Providence washes one of his worms into the sea in a tempest, then starves him and freezes him on a plank for 34 days, and finally wrecks him again on an uninhabited island where he lives on shrimps and grasshoppers and other shellfish for 3 months, and is at last rescued by some old whiskey-soaked profane and blasphemous infidel of a tramp captain and carried home gratis to his friends, the worm forgets that it was Providence that washed him overboard, and only remembers that Providence rescued him. He finds no fault. He has no sarcasms for Providence's crude and slow and labored ingenuities of invention in the matter of life-saving. He sees nothing in these delays and ineffectivenesses but food for admiration. To him they seem a marvel, a miracle. And the longer they take and the more ineffective they are, the greater the miracle. Meantime, he never allows himself to break out in any good, hearty, unhandicapped thanks for the tough old shipmaster who really saved him. He damns him with faint praise as the instrument, his rescuer under Providence. To get to that corner room with its bookcase freighted with $20 worth of ancient blackwood and modern spiritualistic literature, I have passed through, undescribed, a room that is my bedroom. Its size is good, its shape is good, 30 feet by 22. Originally, it was 50 feet long, stretching from one side of the house to the other, in the true Italian fashion which makes everybody's bedroom a passageway into the next room, kings, nobles, serfs, and all. But this American countess, the present owner, cut off 20 feet of the room and reattached 10 feet of it to the room as a bathroom, and devoted the rest to a hallway. This bedroom is lighted by one of those tall glass doors already described, which gives upon the terrace. It is divided across the middle by some polished white pillars as big as my body, with Doric capitals, supporting a small arch at each end and a long one in the middle. This is indeed grandeur and is quite imposing. The fireplace is of a good size, is of white marble, and the carvings upon it are of the dainty and graceful sort proper to its age, which is probably 400 years. The fireplace and the stately columns are aristocratic. They recognize their kinship, and they smile at each other. That is, when they are not swearing at the rest of the room's belongings. The front half of the room is aglare with a paper, loud of pattern, atrocious in color, and cheap beyond the dreams of avarice. The rear half is painted from floor to ceiling a dull, dead, and repulsive yellow. It seems strange that yellow should be the favorite in Europe whereby to undecorate a wall. I've never seen a yellow wall which did not depress me and make me unhappy. The floor of the room is covered with a superannuated nightmare of a carpet whose figures are vast and riotous, and whose indignant reds and blacks and yellows quarrel day and night and refuse to be reconciled. There is a door opening into the bathroom, and at that same end of the room is a door opening into a small box of a hall which leads to another convenience. Those two doors strictly follow the law of European dwellings, whether built for the prince or for the pauper. That is to say, they are rude, thin, cheap planks, flimsy, the sort of door which in the South the Negro attaches to his chicken coop. These doors, like all such doors on the continent, have a gimlet handle in place of a doorknob. It wrenches from the socket a bolt which has no springs and which will not return to that socket except upon compulsion. You can't slam a door like that. It would simply rebound. That gimlet handle catches on any garment that tries to get by. If terrible, it tears it. If not terrible, it stops the wearer with a suddenness and a violence and an unexpectedness which breaks down all his religious reserves, no matter who he may be. The bedroom has a door on each side of the front end, so that anybody may tramp through that wants to at any time of the day or night, this being the only way to get to the room beyond, where the precious library is bookcased. Furniture, a salmon-colored silk sofa, a salmon-colored silk chair, a pair of ordinary wooden chairs, and a stuffed chair whose upholstery is of a species unknown to me but devilish. In the corner, an ordinary thin-legged kitchen table. Against one wall, a wardrobe and a dressing bureau. On the opposite side, a rickety chest of drawers made of white pine, painted black, and ornamented with imitation brass handles. Brass double bedstead. One will concede that this room is not over-embarrassed with furniture. The two clapboard doors already spoken of are mercifully concealed by party-colored hangings of unknown country and origin. The three other doors already mentioned are hooded with long curtains that descend to the floor and are caught apart in the middle to permit the passage of people and light. These curtains have a proud and ostentatious look which deceives no one, it being based upon a hybrid silk with cotton for its chief ingredient. The color is a solid yellow and deeper than the yellow of the rearward half of the walls. And now here is a curious thing. One may look from one of these colors to the other 50 times, and each time he will think that the one he is looking at is the ugliest. It is a most curious and interesting effect. I think that if one could get himself toned down to where he could look upon these curtains without passion, he would then perceive that it takes both of them together to be the ugliest color known to art. We have considered these two yellows, but they do not exhaust the matter. There is still another one in the room. This is a lofty and sumptuous canopy over the brass bedstead, and is made of brilliant and shiny and shouting lemon-colored satin. Genuine satin, almost the only genuine thing in the whole room. It is of the nobility, it is of the aristocracy, it belongs with the majestic white pillars and the dainty old marble fireplace. All the rest of the room's belongings are profoundly plebeian. They are exiles. They are sorrowful outcasts from their rightful home, which is the poorhouse. On the wall of the front end, in large frames, hang photographs of the pair who are responsible for the Countess's presence in this world. It would be in better taste if they looked less gratified about it. On the end wall of the yellow half of the room hang a couple of framed engravings, female angels engaged in their customary traffic of transporting departed persons to heaven over a distant prospect of city and plain and mountain. The discords of this room, in colors, in humble poverty and showy and self-complacent pretentiousness, are repeated everywhere one goes in the huge house. I am weary of particulars. One may travel 200 feet down either side of the house through an aimless jumble of useless little reception rooms and showy corridors, finding nothing sane or homelike till he reaches the dining room at the end. On the next floor, over the Blackwood Library, there is a good bedroom well furnished, and with a fine stone balcony and the majestic view just mentioned, enlarged and improved. Thence northward 200 feet, cut up in much the same disarray as is that ground floor. But in the midst is a great drawing-room, about 40 feet square and perhaps as many high, handsomely and tastefully hung with brocaded silk, and with a very beautifully frescoed ceiling. But the place has a most angry look, for scattered all about it are divans and sofas and chairs and lofty window-hangings of that same fierce lemon-colored satin heretofore noted as forming the canopy of the brass bedstead downstairs. When one steps suddenly into that great place on a splendid Florentine day, it is like entering hell on a Sunday morning when the brightest and yellowest brimstone fires are going. I think I have said that the top floor has 20 rooms. They are not furnished, they are spacious, and from all of them one has a wide and charming view. Properly furnished, they would be pleasant, homelike, and in every way satisfactory. End of March. Now that we have lived in this house 4.5 months, my prejudices have fallen away one by one, and the place has become very homelike to me. Under certain conditions, I should like to go on living in it indefinitely. Indeed, I could reduce the conditions to 2 and be quite satisfied. I should want that stable over which the Countess lives, since it is not pleasant to have the horses stabled under Mrs. Clemens's bedchamber. Also, I should wish the Countess to move out of Italy, out of Europe, out of the planet. I should want her bonded to retire to her place in the next world and inform me which of the 2 it was, so that I could arrange for my own hereafter. The friends who secured this house for me while I was still in America were as well acquainted with the Countess's pestiferous character as was gossipy Florence, but they allowed her to beguile them into the belief that she was going to Paris to live as soon as her expensive house was off her hands. It was a mistake. She never meant to go. She could not endure life without the daily and hourly society of her handsome chief manservant, and she was not rich enough to take him along. There being nothing in the least requiring the Countess to go to Paris or to some other heaven suited to her style, I soon realized that there was no way of abolishing her. And so after 2.5 months of her odorous presence in the neighborhood, her stable dwelling being within the grounds of the estate, I gave it up and have been house hunting ever since. House hunting in any country is difficult and depressing. In the regions skirting Florence, it leads to despair, and if persisted in, will end in suicide. Professor Willard Fisk, the scholar who bought the Walter Savage Lander Villa 14 or 15 years ago, tells me that he examined 300 villas before he found one that would suit him. Yet he was a widower without child or dependent, and merely needed a villa for his lone self. I was in it 12 years ago, and it seemed to me that he had not bought a villa, but only a privilege, the privilege of building it over again and making it humanly habitable. During the first 3 weeks of February, I climbed around, over, and prowled through an average of 6 large villas a week, but found none that would answer in the circumstances. One of the circumstances, and the most important of all, being that we are in Italy by the command of physicians, in the hope that in this mild climate Mrs. Clemens will get her health back. She suddenly lost it 19 months ago, being smitten, helpless, by nervous prostration complicated with an affection of the heart of several years' standing. And the times since this collapse that she has been able to stand on her feet 5 minutes at a time have been exceedingly rare. I have examined 2 villas that were about as large as this one, but the interior architecture was so ill-contrived that there was not comfortable room in them for my family of 4 persons. As a rule, the bedchambers served as common hallways, which means that for centuries, Tom, Dick, and Harry of both sexes and all ages have moved in procession to and fro through those ostensibly private rooms. Every villa I examined had a number of the details which I was ordered to find. Four possessed almost every one of them. In the case of the four, the altitudes were not satisfactory to the doctors. Two of them were too high, and the other pair too low. These 15 or 20 villas were all furnished. The reader of these notes will find that word in the dictionary, and it will be defined there, but that definition can have no value to a person who is desiring to know what the word means over here when it is attached to an advertisement proposing to let a dwelling house. Here it means a meager and scattering array of cheap and rickety chairs, tables, sofas, etc., upholstered in worn and damaged fragments of somber and melancholy hue that suggest the grave and compel the desire to retire to it. The average villa is properly a hospital for ailing and superannuated furniture. In its best days, this furniture was never good, nor comely, nor attractive, nor comfortable. When that best day was too long ago for anyone to be able to date it now. Each time that I have returned from one of these quests, I have been obliged to concede that the insurrection of color in this Villa di Quarto is a rest of the eye after what I had been sighing and sorrowing over in those others, and that this is the only villa in the market, so far as I know, that has furniture enough in it for the needs of the occupants. Also, I will concede that I was wrong in thinking this villa poverty-stricken in the matter of conveniences, for by contrast with those others, this house is rich in conveniences. Some time ago, a lady told me that she had just returned from a visit to the country palace of a princess, a huge building standing in the midst of a great and beautiful and carefully kept flower garden, the garden in its turn being situated in a great and beautiful private park. She was received by a splendid apparition of the footman species, who ushered her into a lofty and spacious hall richly garnished with statuary, pictures, and other ornaments, fine and costly, and thence down an immensely long corridor which shone with a similar garniture, superb and showy to the last degree. And at the end of this enchanting journey she was delivered into the princess's bedchamber and received by the princess, who was ailing slightly, and in bed. The room was very small. It was without bric-a-brac or prettinesses for the comfort of the eye and spirit. The bedstead was iron. There were two wooden chairs and a small table, and in the corner stood an iron tripod which supported a common white washbowl. The costly glories of the house were all for show. No money had been wasted on its mistress's comfort. I had my doubts about this story when I first acquired it. I am more credulous now. A word or two more concerning the furnishings of the Villa di Quarto. The rooms contain an average of four pictures each, say two photographs or engravings and two oil or watercolor paintings of chromo degree. A number of these paintings are from the Countess's hand, and several of them exhibit talent of a moderate sort. One of her works is a portrait, apparently from a photograph, of the Philadelphia man whose intimacies with her enabled her first husband to relieve himself of her society by divorce. This divorced lady was flourishing under her maiden name of Paxton when she was married to the Count in Philadelphia. In America, she is a married woman. In Italy, she is not. She has studied art. 25 or 30 drawings upholster the walls of a north room of this house, which must have been her studio. These nude men and women are of the detailed and uncompromising nakedness which is the special product of class instruction in the art schools. If I read the Countess aright, it cost her a pang not to hang them in the drawing room. High up on the walls of the great entrance hall hang several of those little shiny white cherubs which one associates with the name of Della Robbia. The walls of this hall are further decorated, or at least relieved, by the usual great frameless oval oil portraits of long-departed aristocrats which one customarily finds thus displayed in all Florentine villas. In the present case, the portraits were painted by artists of chromo rank, with the exception of one. As I have had no teaching in art, I cannot decide what is a good picture and what isn't, according to the established standards. I am obliged to depend on my own crude standards. According to these, the picture which I am now considering sets forth a most noble, grave, and beautiful face, faultless in all details, and with beautiful and faultless hands. And if it belonged to me, I would never take a lesson in art, lest the picture lose for me its finished, complete, and satisfying perfection. The Countess is 2 or 3 years past 40, and by the generous supply of portraits and photographs of her distributed over the house, one perceives that she has once been comely and at intervals pretty. She now paints her face and dyes her hair, and in other ways tries to preserve the tradition of those lost days, but she carries that within her which defeats the dearest efforts of art and spoils their attempts to keep her exterior aspects in satisfactory shape. That interior something is her spirit, her disposition. She is excitable, malicious, malignant, vengeful, unforgiving, selfish, stingy, avaricious, coarse, vulgar, profane, obscene, a furious blusterer on the outside and at heart a coward. Her lips are as familiar with lies, deceptions, swindles, and treacheries as are her nostrils with breath. She has not a single friend in Florence. She is not received in any house. I think she is the best-hated person I have ever known, and the most liberally despised. She is an oppressor by nature, and a taker of mean advantages. She is hated by every peasant and every person on the estate and in the neighborhood of it, with the single exception of her paramour, the steward. She told me that when she bought the estate, the first thing she did was to drive from it every peasant family but one. She did not make this as a confession. The whole tone of it was that of a boast, and nowhere in it was there any accent of pity. She knew that those people and their fathers had held those small homes for generations, and had by authority of the kindly customs of the country regarded them as being secure to them so long as their conduct should remain good. She knew that to turn them out upon the world was to them a terrible calamity, that it was almost the equivalent to sweeping islanders into the sea. She knew that these people were bound to their homes by their heartstrings. One of the peasants whom she evicted lived 6 weeks and died with nothing the matter with him. That is, nothing the matter with him that a physician's drugs could reach, nothing that is named in the medical man's books, nothing for which his science has provided either diagnosis or remedy. The man's friends had no doubts as to the nature of his malady. They said his heart was where anybody's heart would be, in his home, and that when that was taken from him, his heart went with it, and thereby his life was spoiled, and no longer livable with profit. The Countess boasted to me that nothing American is still left in her, and that she is wholly Italian now. She plainly regarded this as a humiliation for America, and she has plainly believed she was gracing Italy with a compliment of a high and precious order. America still stands. Italy may survive the benefaction of the Countess's approval. We cannot tell. There is something pathetically comical about this forlorn exile's dream and its failure. She imagined that a title was all that was needed to frank her into the heaven of the privileged orders of Europe, whereas she finds she is not even able to penetrate the outer fringe of it. She overlooked an all-important detail, money. If she had had that, her destitution of character would not have counted. Lacking that, her soiled name, her execrable nature, and her residence in a stable with her manservant and the other cattle all count against her. She brought no money and had none to bring. If she had a credit of 10 millions at the bank, not many doors would be closed against her. Being lean of purse, none is opened to her. She has assailed, she has furiously assailed ladies in the street for not returning her visits and for pretending to be out when she called. This is regarded as not good form. Hers is a curious situation. It is good to be a real noble. It is good to be a real American. It is a calamity to be neither the one thing nor the other, a politico-social bastard on both counts. The trivial maliciousness that this soured outcast can invent. My agent here, a solicitor, paid 2,500 francs, the rent of the first quarter, before we sailed from America, and this secured possession for the first day of November. On that date he tried to put our servants in the house, and the Countess drove him and them away, and he stood it like a little man. She said no one would be allowed to enter until the inventory had been made out and signed. She put that detail off a week, and this gave her an opportunity to rob the house. She removed from it all the furniture she could stow and use in her apartment of 12 rooms over the stable and cattle stalls. We arrived on the 7th, stayed in town 2 days to rest my invalid wife from the racking railway journey from Genoa. The Countess's head servant and the solicitor reported the house in good order, and we made the long drive on the 9th and entered into occupation, to find that no fires had been lighted in the furnaces or elsewhere, and that the place was in condition for no office but the preservation of products requiring cold storage. Jean and our old Katie had preceded us by half an hour to make sure that everything was in right shape. They found the countess on hand and lording it over the house which had been taken and paid for. No bed had been prepared for the invalid. The countess refused to give up the keys to the bedding closets and said she would not allow a bed to be made for anyone until the inventory should have been gone over and signed. She wouldn't tell where in the vast building our trunks were concealed. Otherwise, bedding could have been taken from these. When we arrived, we soon found out where our trunks were, and we set the servants to work to prepare a bed. We selected for Mrs. Clemens the sacred room with the silken tapestry. The Countess forbade the presence in that room of any sick person, and appealed to the lease and to my lawyer, who was present, in support of this prohibition. She was correct in her position. The lease showed that this reptile with the filthy soul had protected her house and her body against physical contamination by inserting in the lease a clause prohibiting the lessee from introducing into that particular bedroom any person suffering from an illness of any kind, whether contagious or otherwise, and whether the illness might be large or small, to use the words of the translation of the lease. And to these rigors she had added a clause breaking the lease in case I should bring a contagious disease into the house. All these sillinesses my salaried ass had conceded. During the 15 months that Mrs. Clemens had been a helpless invalid, she had constantly received the gentle courtesies and kindly attentions which human beings of whatsoever rank or nationality always and everywhere accord to helplessness. This American countess was the first of the race to deny these graces and to inflict physical pain and damage instead. Considering the known character of the woman, the lease was not a curiosity, for it left many loopholes for the gratification of her whims and caprices and malices, but left no holes for our escape or defense. Her rights were set forth in detail in writing in every instance, whereas some of our most important ones had no protection other than her oral promises. These promises were ignored and repudiated from the start, and quite frankly, by oral promise, we could occupy as much of the stable as we pleased, but the written lease confined us to the stable under Mrs. Clemens's room. By oral agreement, she was to leave the estate as soon as we moved in, a most important detail, and by all means should have been in writing, for no one acquainted with the Countess would endure the stench of her presence within a mile of his dwelling if it could be helped. By oral promise, we were to have command of the reservoir which furnished water to the house, which was another exceedingly important detail. But as it was not in writing, she was able to keep that command herself, and she continues to keep it, and now and then to use it against our convenience and our health. The lease gave us not a single privilege outside the building except exit and entrance through the grounds. We were not consulted as to what hours the great gates should be open. It pleased her to close them for the night at 6 o'clock, wherefore we were not only prisoners from that time until the next morning, but we were disastrously unaware of it because she gave us no notice. I say disastrously for the reason that upon one occasion our expensive Florentine specialist, Professor Grocco, with his assistant physician, arrived at the outer gate 400 yards from the villa at 6 o'clock in the evening and found the gate locked. There being no bell, there was no way to give us notice. The assistant, Dr. Nesti, went scouting and found a gate open which led into the podere. Through this, they drove unimpeded to the villa. The pretext for closing the great gates out at the main road and those contiguous to our house was to protect the podere from thieves, whereas that podere gate was often left open all night. The Countess invented various other ways to inconvenience us, and I suppose that the motive was merely and solely malice, but it turns out that that was not the whole of it. She was trying to force us to throw pecuniary advantages in the way of her temporary husband, her chief manservant. She had expected that we would buy all supplies through him and thus extend to him the same opportunities to rob us which he was enjoying in robbing her. She was curiously communicative in this matter. She told me I had made a mistake in not buying the winter's fuel through that man, and in not buying the winter supply of wine and oil through him, and in not furnishing a cart and horse to our cook wherewith to drive into Florence daily for the perishable foods for the table, and in not getting him to have our washing done for us, and in not making it worth his while to be friendly with us as regards the water, since he could shut it off whenever he pleased, and could also waste it and make it necessary for us to buy water outside and have it hauled to us, a thing which he did once for a week or two. The lease forbade me to add an improvement or a convenience anywhere about the house without first getting her consent in writing. Our physicians were 3 or 4 miles away in Florence. Several times, Mrs. Clemens had desperate need of them, and each time it cost us more than an hour and a half of precious time to send in and get them. A telephone was necessary, and I asked the Countess to allow me to put one in. She said I might, but that she must be sent for when the telephone people should arrive to put in the instrument, so that she might determine for herself whereabouts in the house she would allow it to be located. It did not occur to me to ask her to put the permission in writing, for I was not yet able to realize that I was not dealing with a human being, but with a reptile. Through Mr. Chakey, the manager of the bank, the contract was at once made with the telephone company. There were 27 orders ahead of me, but by courtesy of the company and in consideration of the desperate need I had of the telephone, I was placed at the head of the list. My instrument was promptly put in, and in the last days of January it began its work in perfect order. It maintained this perfect order an hour, and then died. During a whole month thereafter, Mr. Chakey did his best to find out what the trouble was. The company furnished all sorts of excuses, except rational ones, and still the telephone remained dumb. Close upon the end of January, I heard from a trustworthy source that the Countess had said to a friend of hers, the only one she has in Italy, apparently, that if I had put the telephone matter into the hands of her paramour, there would never have been any trouble about it. I went to town, and Mr. Chakey telephoned the company and asked them to state once for all when they proposed to blow the breath of life into my telephone. They answered that the Countess was threatening them with a suit for 18 francs damage, which they had caused by erecting a telephone pole in her podere, the actual damage being, if anything, not above 5 francs. Also that they had just received an order from the Countess, accompanied by a threat from her lawyer, requiring them to take my telephone out on or before the 4th day of February at noon. I asked Mr. Chakey to say to the company that if I found myself unable to communicate with my house by telephone before sunset, I should bring suit for 25,000 francs damages for failure to fulfill their contract with me. Communication with my house was perfected within the hour and has never since been interrupted. The Countess's excuse for forbidding a telephone whose special and particular office was to speedily call physicians to save a neighbor's threatened life was that I had no permission from her in writing and had not notified her to come and say where the instrument might be placed. I was losing my belief in hell until I got acquainted with the Countess Massilia. We have lived in a Florentine villa before. This was 12 years ago. This was the Villa Viviani, and was pleasantly and commandingly situated on a hill in the suburb of Settignano, overlooking Florence and the Great Valley. It was secured for us and put in comfortable order by a good friend, Mrs. Ross, whose stately castle was a 12 minutes' walk away. She still lives there and has been a help to us more than once since we got into the fangs of the titled animal who owns the Villa di Quarto. The year spent in the Villa Viviani was something of a contrast to the 5 months which we have now spent in this ducal barrack. Among my old manuscripts and random and spasmodic diaries, I find some account of that pleasantly remembered year, and will make some extracts from the same and introduce them here. When we were passing through Florence in the spring of 92 on our way to Germany, the diseased world's bathhouse, we began negotiations for a villa, and friends of ours completed them after we were gone. When we got back 3 or 4 months later, everything was ready, even to the servants and the dinner. It takes but a sentence to state that, but it makes an indolent person tired to think of the planning and work and trouble that lie concealed in it. For it is less trouble and more satisfaction to bury 2 families than to select and equip a home for 1. The situation of the villa was perfect. It was 3 miles from Florence, on the side of a hill. The flowery terrace on which it stood looked down upon sloping olive groves and vineyards. To the right, beyond some hill spurs, was Fiesole, perched upon its steep terraces. In the immediate foreground was the imposing mass of the Ross Castle, its walls and turrets rich with the mellow weather stains of forgotten centuries. In the distant plain lay Florence, pink and gray and brown, with the rusty huge dome of the cathedral dominating its center like a captive balloon, and flanked on the right by the smaller bulb of the Medici Chapel, and on the left by the airy tower of the Palazzo Vecchio. All around the horizon was a billowy rim of lofty blue hills, snowed white with innumerable villas. After 9 months of familiarity with this panorama, I still think, as I thought in the beginning, that this is the fairest picture on our planet, the most enchanting to look upon, the most satisfying to the eye and the spirit. to see the sun sink down, drowned in his pink and purple and golden floods, and overwhelm Florence with tides of color that make all the sharp lines dim and faint and turn the solid city to a city of dreams, is a sight to stir the coldest nature and make a sympathetic one drunk with ecstasy. September 26th, 92. Arrived in Florence, got my head shaved. This was a mistake. Moved to the villa in the afternoon. Some of the trunks brought up in the evening by the contadino, if that is his title. He is the man who lives on the farm and takes care of it for the owner, the Marquis. The contadino is middle-aged and like the rest of the peasants, that is to say, brown, handsome, good-natured, courteous, and entirely independent without making any offensive show of it. He charged too much for the trunks, I was told. My informant explained that this was customary. September 27th. The rest of the trunks brought up this morning. He charged too much again, but I was told that this also was customary. It is all right, then. I do not wish to violate the customs. Hired landau, horses, and coachmen. Terms, 480 francs a month and a pourboire to the coachman. I to furnish lodging for the man and the horses, but nothing else. The landau has seen better days and weighs 30 tons. The horses are feeble and object to the landau. They stop and turn around every now and then and examine it with surprise and suspicion. This causes delay. But it entertains the people along the road. They came out and stood around with their hands in their pockets and discussed the matter with each other. I was told they said that a 40-ton landau was not the thing for horses like those. What they needed was a wheelbarrow. I will insert in this place some notes made in October concerning the villa. This is a two-story house. It is not an old house, from an Italian standpoint, I mean. No doubt there has always been a nice dwelling on this eligible spot since 1,000 years B.C., but this present one is said to be only 200 years old. Outside, it is a plain square building like a box and is painted a light yellow and has green window shutters. It stands in a commanding position on an artificial terrace of liberal dimensions, which is walled around with strong masonry. From the walls, the vineyards and olive orchards of the estate slant away toward the valley. The garden about the house is stocked with flowers and a convention of lemon bushes in great crockery tubs. There are several tall trees, stately stone pines, also fig trees and trees of breeds not familiar to me. Roses overflow the retaining walls and the battered and mossy stone urns on the gateposts in pink and yellow cataracts, exactly as they do on the drop curtains of theaters. There are gravel walks shut in by tall laurel hedges. The back corner of the terrace is occupied by a dense grove of old ilex trees. There is a stone table in there with stone benches around it. No shaft of sunlight can penetrate that grove. It is always deep twilight in there, even when all outside is flooded with the intense sun glare common to this region. The carriage road leads from the inner gate 800 feet to the public road, through the vineyard, and there one may take the horse car for the city and will find it a swifter and handier convenience than a 60-ton landau. On the east, or maybe it is the south, front of the house is the Viviani coat of arms in plaster, and near it a sundial, which keeps very good time. The house is a very fortress for strength. The main walls, of brick covered with plaster, are about 3 feet thick. The partitions of the rooms, also of brick, are nearly the same thickness. The ceilings of the rooms on the ground floor are more than 20 feet high. Those of the upper floors are also higher than necessary. I have several times tried to count the rooms in the house, but the irregularities baffle me. There seem to be 28. The ceilings are frescoed, the walls are papered. All the floors are of red brick covered with a coating of polished and shining cement which is as hard as stone and looks like it. For the surfaces have been painted in patterns, first in solid colors and then snowed over with vari-colored freckles of paint to imitate granite and other stones. Sometimes the body of the floor is an imitation of gray granite with a huge star or other ornamental pattern of imitation fancy marbles in the center. With a 2-foot band of imitation red granite all around the room, whose outer edge is bordered with a 6-inch stripe of imitation lapis lazuli. Sometimes the body of the floor is red granite, then the gray is used as a bordering stripe. There are plenty of windows and worlds of sun and light. These floors are slick and shiny and full of reflections, for each is a mirror in its way, softly imaging all objects after the subdued fashion of forest lakes. There is a tiny family chapel on the main floor, with benches for 10 or 12 persons, and over the little altar is an ancient oil painting which seems to me to be as beautiful and as rich in tone as any of those old master performances down yonder in the galleries of the Pitti and the Uffizi. Botticelli, for instance. I wish I had time to make a few remarks about Botticelli, whose real name was probably Smith. The curious feature of the house is the salon. This is a spacious and lofty vacuum which occupies the center of the house. All the rest of the house is built around it. It extends up through both stories, and its roof projects some feet above the rest of the building. That vacuum is very impressive. The sense of its vastness strikes you the moment you step into it and cast your eyes around it and aloft. I tried many names for it: the skating rink, the mammoth cave, the Great Sahara, and so on. But none exactly answered. There are 5 divans distributed along its walls. They make little or no show, though their aggregate length is 57 feet. A piano in it is a lost object. We have tried to reduce the sense of desert space and emptiness with tables and things, but they have a defeated look and do not do any good. Whatever stands or moves under that soaring painted vault is belittled. Over the 6 doors are huge plaster medallions which are supported by great naked and handsome plaster boys. And in these medallions are plaster portraits in high relief of some grave and beautiful men in stately official costumes of a long past day. Florentine senators and judges, ancient dwellers here and owners of this estate. The date of one of them is 1305. Middle-aged, then, and a judge. He could have known as a youth the very creators of Italian art, and he could have walked and talked with Dante, and probably did. The date of another is 1343. He could have known Boccaccio and spent his afternoons yonder in Fiesole, gazing down on plague-reeking Florence and listening to that man's improper tales, and he probably did. The date of another is 1463. He could have met Columbus, and he knew the magnificent Lorenzo, of course. These are all Cerretanis, or Cerretani twains, as I may say, for I have adopted myself into their family on account of its antiquity, my origin having been heretofore too recent to suit me. But I am forgetting to state what it is about that rink that is so curious, which is that it is not really vast, but only seems so. It is an odd deception and unaccountable, but a deception it is. Measured by the eye, it is 60 feet square and 60 high, but I have been applying the tape line and find it to be but 40 feet square and 40 high. These are the correct figures. And what is interestingly strange is that the place continues to look as big now as it did before I measured it. This is a good house, but it cost very little and is simplicity itself and pretty primitive in most of its features. The water is pumped to the ground floor from a well by hand labor and then carried upstairs by hand. There is no drainage. The cesspools are right under the windows. This is the case with everybody's villa. The doors in this house are like the doors of the majority of the houses and hotels of Italy, plain, thin, unpaneled boards painted white. This makes the flimsiest and most unattractive door known to history. The knob is not a knob, but a thing like the handle of a gimlet. You can get hold of it only with your thumb and forefinger. Still, even that is less foolish than our American doorknob, which is always getting loose and turning futilely round and round in your hand, accomplishing nothing. The windows are all of the rational continental breed. They open apart like doors, and when they are bolted for the night, they don't rattle, and a person can go to sleep. There are cunning little fireplaces in the bedrooms and sitting rooms, and lately a big aggressive-looking German stove has been set up on the south frontier of the Great Sahara. The stairs are made of granite blocks. The hallways of the second floor are of red brick. It is a safe house. Earthquakes cannot shake it down, fire cannot burn it. There's absolutely nothing burnable but the furniture, the curtains, and the doors. There's not much furniture, it is merely summer furniture, or summer bareness, if you like. When a candle set fire to the curtains in a room over my head the other night where samples of the family slept, I was wakened out of my sleep by shouts and screams, and was greatly terrified until an answer from the window told me what the matter was, that the window curtains and hangings were on fire. In America, I should have been more frightened than ever then, but this was not the case here. I advised the samples to let the fire alone and go to bed, which they did, and by the time they got to sleep, there was nothing of the attacked fabrics left. We boast a good deal in America of our fire departments, the most efficient and wonderful in the world, but they have something better than that to boast of in Europe, a rational system of building which makes human life safe from fire and renders fire departments needless. We boast of a thing which we ought to be ashamed to require. This villa has a roomy look, a spacious look, and when the sunshine is pouring in and lighting up the bright colors of the shiny floors and walls and ceilings, there is a large and friendly suggestion of welcome about the aspects. But I do not know that I have ever seen a continental dwelling which quite met the American standard of a home in all the details. There is a trick about an American house that is like the deep-lying, untranslatable idioms of a foreign language, a trick uncatchable by the stranger, a trick incommunicable and undescribable. And that elusive trick, that intangible something, whatever it is just the something that gives the home look and the home feeling to an American house and makes it the most satisfying refuge yet invented by men, and women, mainly women. The American house is opulent in soft and varied colors that please and rest the eye, and in surfaces that are smooth and pleasant to the touch, in forms that are shapely and graceful, in objects without number which compel interest and cover nakedness. And the night has even a higher charm than the day, there, for the artificial lights do really give light instead of merely trying and failing. And under their veiled and tinted glow, all the snug coziness and comfort and charm of the place is at its best and loveliest. But when night shuts down on the continental home, there is no gas or electricity to fight it, but only dreary lamps of exaggerated ugliness and of incomparable poverty in the matter of effectiveness. September 29th, 92. I seem able to forget everything except that I have had my head shaved. No matter how closely I shut myself away from drafts, it seems to be always breezy up there. But the main difficulty is the flies. They like it up there better than anywhere else, on account of the view, I suppose. It seems to me that I have never seen any flies before that were shod like these. These appear to have talons. Wherever they put their foot down, they grab. They walk over my head all the time and cause me infinite torture. It is their park, their club, their summer resort. They have garden parties there and conventions and all sorts of dissipation. And they fear nothing. All flies are daring, but these are more daring than those of other nationalities. These cannot be scared away by any device. They are more diligent, too, than the other kinds. They come before daylight and stay till after dark. But there are compensations. The mosquitoes are not a trouble. There are very few of them. They are not noisy and not much interested in their calling. A single unkind word will send them away, if said in English, which impresses them because they do not understand it. Then they come no more that night. We often see them weep when they are spoken to harshly. I've got some of the eggs to take home. If this breed can be raised in our climate, they will be a great advantage. There seem to be no fleas here. This is the first time we have struck this kind of an interregnum in 15 months. Everywhere else the supply exceeds the demand. October 1st. Finding that the coachman was taking his meals in the kitchen, I reorganized the contract to include his board at 30 francs a month. That is what it would cost him up above us in the village, and I think I can feed him for 200 and save 30 out of it. Saving 30 is better than not saving anything. That passage from the diary reminds me that I did an injudicious thing along about that time, which bore fruit later. As I was to give the coachman, Vittorio, a monthly pourboire, of course I wanted to know the amount. So I asked the coachman's padrone, master, instead of asking somebody else, anybody else. He said 30 francs a month would be about right. I was afterwards informed that this was an overcharge, but that it was customary, there being no customary charges except overcharges. However, at the end of that month, the coachman demanded an extra pourboire of 15 francs. When I asked why, he said his padrone had taken his other pourboire away from him. The padrone denied this in Vittorio's presence, and Vittorio seemed to retract. The padrone said he did, and he certainly had that aspect, but I had to take the padrone's word for it as interpreter of the coachman's Italian. When the padrone was gone, the coachman resumed the charge, and as we liked him and also believed him, We made his aggregate pourboire 45 francs a month after that, and never doubted that the padrone took 2/3 of it. We were told by citizens that it was customary for the padrone to seize a considerable share of his dependent's pourboire, and also the custom for the padrone to deny it. That padrone is an accommodating man and a most capable and agreeable talker, speaking English like an archangel, and making it next to impossible for a body to be dissatisfied with him. Yet his 70-ton landau has kept us supplied with lame horses for 9 months, whereas we were entitled to a light carriage suited to hill climbing, and fastidious people would have made him furnish it. The Ceritani family, of old and high distinction in the great days of the Republic, lived on this place during many centuries. Along in October, we began to notice a pungent and suspicious odor which we were not acquainted with, and which gave us some little apprehension, but I laid it on the dog, and explained to the family that that kind of a dog always smelt that way when he was up to windward of the subject, but privately I knew it was not the dog at all. I believed it was our adopted ancestors, the Ceritanis. I believed they were preserved under the house somewhere, and that it would be a good scheme to get them out and air them. But I was mistaken. I made a secret search and had to acquit the ancestors. It turned out that the odor was a harmless one. It came from the wine crop, which was stored in a part of the cellars to which we had no access. This discovery gave our imaginations a rest, and it turned a disagreeable smell into a pleasant one. But not until we had so long and so lavishly flooded the house with odious disinfectants that the dog left and the family had to camp in the yard most of the time. It took 2 months to disinfect the disinfectants and persuade our wealth of atrocious stenches to emigrate. When they were finally all gone and the wine fragrance resumed business at the old stand, we welcomed it with effusion, and have had no fault to find with it since. October 6th. I find myself at a disadvantage here. 4 persons in the house speak Italian and nothing else. 1 person speaks German and nothing else. The rest of the talk is in the French, English, and profane languages. I am equipped with but the merest smattering in these tongues, if I except one or two. Angelo speaks French, a French which he could get a patent on because he invented it himself, a French which no one can understand, a French which resembles no other confusion of sounds heard since Babel, a French which curdles the milk. He prefers it to his native Italian. He loves to talk it, loves to listen to himself. To him it is music. He will not let it alone. The family would like to get their little Italian savings into circulation, but he will not give change. It makes no difference what language he is addressed in. His reply is in French, his peculiar French, his grating, uncanny French, which sounds like shoveling anthracite down a coal chute. I know a few Italian words and several phrases, and along at first I used to keep them bright and fresh by wetting them on Angelo. But he partly couldn't understand them and partly didn't want to, so I have been obliged to withdraw them from the market for the present. But this is only temporary. I am practicing. I am preparing. Some day I shall be ready for him, and not in ineffectual French, but in his native tongue. I will see that this kid in its mother's milk. October 27th. The first month is finished. We are wanted now. It is agreed that life at a Florentine villa is an ideal existence. The weather is divine, the outside aspects lovely, the days and the nights tranquil and reposeful, the seclusion from the world and its worries as satisfactory as a dream. There is no housekeeping to do, no plans to make, no marketing to superintend. All these things do themselves, apparently. One is vaguely aware that somebody is attending to them, just as one is aware that the world is being turned over and the constellations worked and the sun shoved around according to the schedule, but that is all. One does not feel personally concerned or in any way responsible. Yet there is no head, no chief executive. Each servant minds his or her own department, requiring no supervision and having none. They hand in elaborately itemized bills once a week, then the machinery goes silently on again, just as before. There is no noise or fussing or quarreling or confusion. Upstairs, I don't know what goes on below. Late in the afternoons, friends come out from the city and drink tea in the open air and tell what is happening in the world. And when the great sun sinks down upon Florence and the daily miracle begins, they hold their breath and look. It is not a time for talk.